This is Karen Brewster, and today is November 2nd, 2021, and I'm here in Anchorage, Alaska with Pat Porchot for the Iditarod National Historic Trail Project Jukebox Project. And Pat, thank you for coming and joining me today in the Atwood Building.
Yeah, happy to.
And just to give a little background before we get to your role in the Iditarod Trail, a little bit about some of the numerous other things you've done and when you came to Alaska.
Yeah, well, I came to Alaska in 1972, almost 50 years ago, from Denver, Colorado, where I was working for the U.S. Bureau of Outdoor Recreation. And I transferred up here with the Bureau of Outdoor Recreation to work primarily on Alaska lands issues that were mandated studies from the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act in 1971. And
so D2 lands?
So-called D2 lands, right. And in the process, after those initial studies were done, we did some other work, including the Bureau of Outdoor Recreation was charged not only with wild and scenic rivers, which I originally was working on in Alaska, but also it had primary responsibility for the Alaska Trail system that was established in 1968. And it designated two national scenic trails, the Appalachian Trail and the Pacific Crest Trail. But a section of the bill also called for the study of additional trails, including some national historic trails, Oregon Trail, the Mormon Pioneer Trail, the Lewis and Clark Trail, and, quote, Gold Rush Trails in Alaska. There was no further explanation of that, presumably put in by some of our delegation back in the 60s. Subsequent to all of that, I worked in a number of different areas, including serving the Alaska legislature as both a representative and a senator, and worked for some nonprofit groups, including environmental groups, and I worked for the Alaska Federation of Natives as a land planner, and worked for Governor Tony Knowles, first as his legislative director and then as the commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. And then more recently, I served as a special assistant to the Secretary of the Interior for Alaska Affairs here in Alaska, working for the Secretary on federal natural resource issues in Alaska. And I retired in 2016, I guess.
Okay. So that, for your special assistant to the Secretary of Interior, was under which presidential administration?
The Obama administration,
okay.
First with Secretary Salazar, and then Secretary
I want to say Jewell, but...
Yeah, Sally Jewell, thank
yeah, okay.
you.
I wasn't sure she was Secretary of Interior
right.
of the Park Service, but...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So your involvement with the Iditarod National Historic Trail goes back to that Gold Rush Trail study then?
Correct. And nobody had done any of the study work, but then we had a team from the Bureau of Outdoor Recreation up in Alaska. There were originally five of us, and then in 74, a couple of the folks transferred back out again, and there was just two or three of us left in the office here. And in addition to the follow-up work and the EIS work on wild and scenic rivers, which we were originally charged with, it was they kind of re-realized that there were this study that was called for in the National Trail System Act in 1968 to study for potential designation as a National Historic Trail or trails, Gold Rush Trails in Alaska. And so we started kind of casting about doing some research on what were some of the leading Gold Rush trails. And it was first just kind of a listing exercise of lots of different trails We started looking with a little more depth at the Chilkoot Trail, the Dalton Trail, which ran from Haines to into the interior, into the gold fields, the Valdez Trail, which, from Valdez to the interior, Fairbanks, and also branches to the Klondike. And why what was dubbed Wiseman Trails, which was really a complex network of trails leading from Fairbanks to the Brooks Range, to the Wiseman area, and other places, and it took various routes. And the Iditarod Trail, running from Seward to the first the Gold Trail of Iditarod. That was the original historic trail. As we got into the study then later, the Iditarod dog sled race had been initiated in 72, and by the time we were doing the study, there was a lot of focus on the race trail in addition to the historic trail, and so our study included the race route and several branches, you know, to Iditarod and alternate branches through the Chugach Mountains and some other places. Soon into, I was involved in the looking at the Dalton Trail and the Wiseman Trail and the Iditarod, and another guy was looked into the Chilkoot and the Valdez Trail, and soon in we realized that the Chilkoot Trail by then had already been designated within the Klondike National Historic Park, and it was fairly well protected and being used as a recreation trail managed by the Park Service. The Dalton Trail had been largely overlain by the Haines cutoff, the road out of Haines. The Valdez, similarly, the Richardson Highway was mostly overlaid the original trail. The Wiseman Trail was really not a trail per se. It was a complex of routes. Actually, all the trails were really start out as winter trails, not summer trails. So they took on a different character in Alaska. It wasn't something that was necessarily hikeable or, even road accessible in the case of the Iditarod. But the Iditarod, on the other hand, we felt had, had high historic values. It had some sections that were possible to hike through the Chugach and back of Anchorage, and maybe in the Alaska Range. It had a lot of attention on it because the race was now beginning. It was in its third or fourth year by then, and a lot of national as well as statewide attention on the race and the race route. And so we felt that it had high potential for potential historic trail designation under the Trails Act criteria. And then we did in-depth study. I largely was in charge of conducting that over the next year or two that we started, and it culminated in a report and recommendation in 1977 was the official publication date, recommending National Historic Trail designation for the Iditarod and its various branches. In the process of that, it was actually quite a fun project, and it wasn't something there were a lot of people involved in. I made some contacts with folks that were involved in the race particularly, but had historic interests, namely Vi and Joe Reddington Sr. They lived out in Kinnick, and Joe was he's the father of the Iditarod race, but he also had long-standing interest in the historic routes of the Iditarod, and he personally flew and kept kind of track from the air and on the ground of the historic routes and where they were, and had real good working knowledge of the route, which was a winter route, and it changed a little bit, but there were roadhouses originally from Kinnick all the way to Iditarod. And at that time, in the early and mid-70s, some of the roadhouses still existed and you could see them. And Joe was quite interested in all that. And one memorable day, he invited me out to Kinnick. It was in the winter time, when the trail was more easily seen through clearings in the, you know, with snow cover. And I went up with him in his PA-1, Super Cub. We flew over out of Kinnick, past the Susitna River, and looking at the trail. And he was so eager and so excited about it. And his method of flying was following the exact curvature of the trail. And boy, about an hour into the flight, I was really nauseous. And at one point, I think I asked him to, if we could go back, because it wasn't, you know, like a high elevation overflight. It was down on the deck, kind of following the trail through the woods. I learned a lot from him in that process. And then I did, historic research, looking at the old records of where roadhouses were and what kind of travel and the season travel and alternate routes. And a good example was back here in the Chugach, Crow Pass was used originally as a shorter route from the end of the rail line. The rail line kind of moved up from Seward over the early 1900s, and it's sometimes of the year it was, you could go over Crow Pass and down to the Eagle River area and cut off a lot of cliff and face and what became the Anchorage area. But in the winter time, it was really prone to avalanche, and it was dangerous. It's still dangerous.
Right.
And there was sometimes people would use the Indian route, Ship Pass, mm-hmm. Ship Creek, drainage, and Indian Creek drainage. It's a lower pass and not so much avalanche. And a guy from BLM, Lou Waller, and I. Lou was the BLM outdoor recreation planner. I think he still lives around town here at the state office. And he and I did a couple of winter exploration trips. And one of them was into the Ship Creek Valley. And we got about 2 or 3 miles in from the Ship Creek side. And it was snowing and big wet snow. And we were, on cross-country skis. And we just bogged down. We camped overnight, and then in the morning it was no better, and we turned around and came back. Subsequently, I skied across there a couple of times and hiked across the Crow Pass in the summertime. But the other couple of trips that we had, one was during the race. I thought it'd be a good opportunity to see the route in the wintertime because they were breaking trail. So one of the early years, 74 or 75, a buddy of mine and I skied from Kinnick out past to the checkpoint there on the Susitna River. And it was early March, and it was unbelievably cold that time. And we stupidly, we were out two nights. First night was a little windy, and we camped in some trees, and it was like only zero. The next night, we thought we'd get out of the wind, and we camped down at a low point, and we had a thermometer hanging from a branch where I could see it, at eye level. We were camped out on the snow, and it was 32 below zero that morning, and about 7 when I could read the thermometer, and we were freezing. We had pulled all of our clothes, everything, into the sleeping bags, all our coats, and we were talking to each other and not sleeping. And we said, whatever comes first, either 10 o'clock or 10 below, we're out of here. We're just gonna not eating anything. We're just gonna grab everything and shove on our boots as best we can and ski down until we warmed up. And exactly at 10 o'clock, it was 10 below, and we got up and jammed on our frozen boots and got the skis on and took off. But That was an interesting trip, but it really gave a feel for winter travel along the Iditarod. The next year, Lou Waller from the BLM and another guy who worked for the Park Service, Wild, his last name was Wild. I've kind of forgotten his first name, Larry, I think. And the three of us flew out to the checkpoint at above Finger Lake, kind of in the middle of the Alaska Range. And we skied and camped out two or three nights and skied the race route, which at that time they were going through Ptarmigan Pass, not Roan Pass. There were two side-by-side passes. Ptarmigan Pass was a little gentler and not so much steep downhill like the Roan River Gorge is the scene of many dog team crashes. But we skied the Ptarmigan route down to the Roan River Roadhouse, which was still around. Now it's gone.
Oh, it is.
It washed out. It was kind of in a floodplain area and subsequently washed out. But then it was still around, although they had upgraded another nearby cabin where the race checkpoint people were. So we'd camped out a couple nights before, and one night was 25 below. Very memorable. The northern lights were out, and the mushers were still coming by, not the leaders, but the other trail enders, and they were running at night, and we could hear them calling to their dogs in the night, and it was just very still, but we could hear them yelling at their dogs and talking to their dogs and whistling, and the northern lights were out. It was quite memorable.
Yeah.
But when we got to Roan, the checkpoint guy, the dogs had almost all gone through by then, and he invited us into the cabin, and he had a big stove going, and we were very appreciative of that. But again, it was a great way to see the route and to kind of get a feel for the roadhouse, time. And people were, they were walking sometimes between roadhouses, so they were... I mean, it would have been a long hike, but doable in a day. So it was like 15 to 20 miles.
But in the winter.
In the winter, and people were either
snowshoeing
or even walking if the trail had been packed. It was interesting. I didn't get any accounts of people skiing in those days. Skiing wasn't like it is now. You'd think that, like in Nordic countries, skiing is a big deal, but here, cross-country skiing, it could have been easy, but it wasn't used so much.
Right.
So it was probably a cultural thing more than anything.
I'm going to interrupt you for just 1 second. After you take your sip from your container, if you move it out of your reach a little bit because you're fiddling with it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, thank you.
You can still drink from it, but it makes a little bit of noise. So.
Yep.
But yeah, you're interested about, so people walked, they mushed the original trail, they snowshoed and walked.
Yep.
Did they use horses?
Yep, there were horses. It's surprising, but some of the earlier accounts of exploration around Denali and McKinley in the early days, primarily by prospectors, in the summertime, there are accounts of taking horses, and it was miserable, just lots of marshy, soggy soil, lots of bugs, a lot of river crossings. It was amazing, some of the early transportation methods. And of course, an incentive to a lot of this was gold. And people were doing all kinds of things, risking their lives and to try to reach gold fields or reach prospects of gold.
Well, so was the Iditarod Trail out, was that used in the summer at all historically?
No.
I mean, I think of it as that part of Alaska you would not want to be tromping through in the summertime.
No. There were, and what we identified eventually in the report was winter trail, it would probably And there were routes that changed every winter, depending on snow and ice and water conditions, and that the trail had to be flexible. It couldn't be one surveyed part on the ground. And so we had always thought about a corridor in which you would try to protect land status for the historic route, knowing that it might change, just like the Iditarod race every year. It alternates depending on conditions, somewhat.
Right. Well, and of course, as we say, in the winter, a lot of it was on frozen rivers.
Yep.
And sometimes you have to probably go inland to get around an open spot or something like that.
Right. We did identify a couple of areas, one through the Alaska Range, one through the Chukotka Park here, either Ship Creek Pass or Crow Pass, that had summer potential and suitable for summer travel. The Crow Pass route obviously is popular in the summer, and Indian Pass, the state parks is still looking at upgrading a route out of the stream bed to try to make it more usable and accessible in the summertime. It isn't quite there yet. It is a popular winter route for cross-country skiing. Can be done in a day, either way, from Indian to Arctic Valley or Arctic Valley to Indian. We did it one time. We were breaking trail in 2 feet or more of rotten snow. Oh. We had to keep changing leaders to break trail. It was just melting out from under and crumbling, and so it too varies considerably by seasonality and whether it's a big thaw or a winter, hard winter or easy winter. But parks is still looking at ways of making it a better trail both winter and summer.
Make it a more recreation opportunity.
Yep.
Well, it sounds like you have great luck in picking the best times to go on these expeditions.
Well, yeah. we hit some more unusual conditions on some of these.
You certainly don't plan to go out to look at the route when it's 32 below.
No, and first week of March, you really expect teens, maybe.
Right.
it's not the coldest part of the winter generally. But anyway, we finished the study then, and it got finalized in early in 77. We probably finished our work in 76, and then it went through the typical Washington D.C. reviews and edits, accompanying EIS. The Department of Interior forwarded the recommendation for Iditarod National Historic Trail status to the Congress in 77. And about that same time, I left the Department of Interior and went to work in Washington, D.C. for Senator Mike Gravel, who was the Alaska Senator at the time, along with Senator Stevens. And when I got interviewed, the chief of staff was very interested not only in my so-called D2 work, or the Alaska Lands work, which I had done on particularly wild scenic rivers and national parks, but they also had known, or I told them, that I had worked extensively on the Iditarod Trail study. And probably not coincidentally, Joe Reddington had approached Senator Gravel on one of his trips back to Alaska and was really pushing him and making the case for trying to get some national designation for the Iditarod Trail and the Iditarod race. And so Senator Gravel and the chief of staff were kind of primed for this. They didn't know a lot about it, but I went to work, and Senator Gravel asked me to initiate legislation that would make the Iditarod a National Historic Trail. And so I helped draft the legislation and got the background materials together, and Senator Gravel introduced a standalone bill designating the Iditarod Trail in 77. But it was clear early on to me, I was working primarily on the Alaska Lands legislation, but following some of this other legislation on natural resources, including the Iditarod Trail. And it was clear early on that the standalone bill wasn't going to get much traction with the appropriate committees. They were looking at big stuff, right. Lots of other things. But as it turned out, the National Trails Act in 1968 had also called for study of the Oregon Trail, Lewis and Clark Trail, Mormon Pioneer Trail as potential National Historic Trails. It also designated some study trails for National Scenic Trail, like the Continental Divide Trail. Right. Well, Frank Church was a prominent senior senator from Idaho at the time, and he served on a key committee, the Natural Resources, before the Energy Committee was called the Senate Natural Resources Committee, I believe. And he had introduced a National Historic Trails bill that designated the Lewis and Clark, the Oregon, and the Mormon Pioneer Trail as National Historic Trails. So we didn't enjoy good relations with Senator Frank Church or his staff, really, for a variety of reasons, historic, personality, otherwise.
Same party?
Yep, same party, majority party in the Senate.
Democrat?
Democrat.
Okay.
And I didn't know a lot about that history, but all I knew was when I went to talk with Frank Church's staff, Senator Church's staff, they were cool. They were not necessarily instantly in a mood to help me or Senator Gravel. But I kind of persevered, and in the end, their bill was moving. And I think they realized that it would be a very easy thing to roll in the Iditarod Trail as another National Historic Trail. And they did. And I was very appreciative. I don't know if Senator Gravel was appreciative or not, but it worked. And they rolled the Iditarod in, and I don't remember. They must have had a couple of hearings, but it was very low-key. I think in the session that Congress would have been 77, 78, and there were a lot of things going on in the Natural Resources Committee, not the least of which was the Alaska Lands
Legislation. Right, I was going to say, ANILCA was
and it was hard to kind of separate out those things and treat it separately, because there was a lot of things being discussed about Alaska. But I think fortunately, Iditarod kind of slipped through, as just another historic trail, not a flashpoint in the Alaska lands debate.
Right.
And
it was hidden in with all that other stuff that
right.
nobody noticed.
Yeah. And so Senator Church's bill passed in 78, and the Iditarod was included. And so there was several of these new National Historic Trails designated, including the Iditarod. There was a couple of scenic trails designated, including most notably the Continental Divide Trail. And it was signed into law then in 78. There was very little in the way of description of what was to happen in the bill itself. It was pretty sparse. And so BLM was, when we did the study, that they were always the assumed manager. They owned all the federal land, virtually all the federal land that the Iditarod went through, and the land that wasn't federal was state-owned. And a lot of the route now is, a good share of it goes through state lands.
But the state was still selecting lands at that point?
Right.
Okay.
Or they had selected lands, but they were what was then called light blue on the map, state selections pending, or state selections tentatively approved, TA'd land. They weren't all patented, and the state was still feeling which lands they ultimately wanted to take title to. But there was a lot of the land that was in the interior, you know, through the Alaska Range and, you know, all the way to the Yukon River that was, you know, a lot of it was state land. Anyway, BLM was always the assumed and then designated federal manager. And I think that was, you know, an appropriate choice, a good choice. And once it was designated, I think BLM stepped right up and took it seriously and established, you know, the first task was to do a management plan. They had a statewide advisory committee, and I think they did some input initially, but then at some point they had an advisory committee just for the Iditarod National Historic Trail. And so they started in on the management and hired some folks to look, you know, to kind of structure that. Obviously, they were working closely with the race people who were, you know, quite interested in the designation and the route. There was a lot of effort in identifying where exactly are you talking about, and being a winter trail and varying year to year, that was not a simple question. And at the same time, there was an effort to made to, you know, to, you didn't want to give away portions of the historic trail, you know, in land transactions. And so both the state and the federal government, I think, put some effort into identifying a corridor and then specifics where it was possible to reserve rights away along the trail. And, you know, it was always assumed that that wouldn't necessarily prohibit upgrades of certain places for roads or trails, that it, you know, just like Lewis and Clark or the Oregon Trail. I mean, some of that was upgraded to roads, and people go along the roadway and, you know, look at features of the historic trails. That was conceived as part of a National Historic Trail. Of course, we didn't have any roads, but that was always a question. Well, is that going to block future roads? And I think the answer is clearly no. But where the trail had historic integrity and value, there was, you know, they didn't want to, you know, let people stake, you know, a home site, or the state program then was going in full swing, the open to entry program.
Oh, right.
And, you know, there was concern not just with the Iditarod, but other places that, you know, you open big areas just to staking, and, you know, in that process, you don't want, you know, portions of a historic resource to, you know, just slip by default into private hands that might have larger public value. So I think both the state and the feds, you know, started in to try to identify routes and protect the routes in a reasonable way.
And what about the Homestead Act? Was Homestead that by 1778, it wasn't being used anymore?
It went away in 72 under a phase out till 74.
Okay.
And Alaska was the last place in the United States that that actually allowed and patented, I assume, some homesteads. And that was the last open to homesteading was in the upper Copper River area by Slana.
Yeah.
And even today, there are socioeconomic remnants of that little experiment that, you know, by a lot of accounts, wasn't necessarily good.
Right. But so that didn't affect the acquisition of lands, like you were talking about the open entry thing. That didn't, the Homestead Act was a moot point for the Iditarod Trail.
Okay. Yes.
So back with the work you did in Senator Gravel's office, first, what was Gravel's position on this and his role, if any? besides just introducing the bill?
Well, he was very supportive of it. He was very deferential to Joe Reddington and his wife Vi, and wanted to help, you know, the cause. I think it was a relatively new concept for him. I mean, it was something that I think a constituency brought to him. He thought it was a good idea. I remember early on talking to him, and you know, he wanted to know a little bit about it, and I said how the study had set up a possible designation and how that could work. He liked that. He said, go ahead, do it. At one point, I did go back to him and said, I don't think we're going to get the standalone bill passed, but I think I got a way to tag it onto the National Historic Trail with Senator Church's bill. I don't quite remember that. I don't think he was overjoyed about it, but I think he clearly understood the political scenario and the process at the time, and he said, fine, go ahead and do that. So, you know, I think he was fully supportive of the designation and thought it was a good idea.
Well, it shows how much the staff in a congressional office does.
Yeah.
It sounds like you were doing all the legwork and the behind the scenes. And
which isn't unusual. That's not necessarily
a
testament to me. That's what a normal good staff person would do. To how do I get to the end zone, you know, through various ways.
Right. Well, as we say, that's interesting. You know, we think of, oh, it's the senator or the congressman, but really the staff is doing the research, and you said you were writing the bill and you were doing the maneuvering with Church's staff, and you don't really think about all that is what happens.
Yeah. Boy, you should see, I mean, lots of major legislation has that dynamic going on, but I got it in spades on the Alaska Lands legislation.
Yeah,
there
sure.
was all kinds of staff work that went into that to affect compromise. What do you think about this? What do you think about that? You know, what if we did this? You know, then triangulating and circulating through all the various players. And that's the nature of the legislative process and the nature of staff. And it happens at all levels. I worked in the Alaska legislature, both originally as a staff person and then as a legislator, and staff were very instrumental in, you know, putting the mechanics of the legislation together.
Yeah, that's interesting. So wasn't Gravel with the D2, he was still senator with Anilka passing.
Correct.
Isn't there something between him and Stevens and that Gravel voted one way or something? I don't remember the
details.
They
took much different tactics on the whole legislation, which went on for 3 years, the legislative process. It failed to pass in the first Congress in 78, largely through Gravel's filibuster. Stevens got back. He had left the Energy Committee that was chaired by Scoop Jackson, and in 76, when the legislation was kind of ripe before Congress, after the studies and the administration had submitted proposals and other people had submitted legislative proposals, Stevens got off of, I believe, the Commerce Committee that he was on, and, you know, kind of senior by then, and got back on the Natural Resources Committee. And he then, for the next several years, worked closely with Scoop Jackson, the chair, on the lands bill and trying to effect changes to benefit Alaskan interests of various kinds, economic, commercial, subsistence, other things, in the bill. Gravel was not on the committee, didn't want to get back on the committee, and kind of took a more aloof position and he was really trying to make a political case why this, you know, was unfair to Alaska and how, you know, there should be a lot more accommodation for Alaska interests. And he was a guy noted for bold moves, and so he, you know, did a filibuster at the end of the 78 session, stopping the bill, and then tried again in 80, but failed. There was no support for that. They invoked cloture, cutting off debate on him. And he was in a primary race in August of 80 with the grandson of Ernest Greening, Clark Greening, who had been in the legislature, and lost a week later after his thwarted filibuster, lost the primary. And then it was kind of a waiting game. The Senate went ahead and passed their bill. The House had already passed a bigger bill, a little stronger bill in terms of
conservation.
And everyone waited around for the presidential race that was being held that year between Jimmy Carter, the Democrat, and Ronald Reagan. Conventional wisdom was that if Jimmy Carter won re-election, there would be a better climate the following year to get a more like a House bill. On the other hand, if Reagan were to win, the Senate passed bill might be the best that could be hoped for by the House. And so Reagan won. The House quietly accepted the Senate version of the bill. It did contain a lot of provisions for special kind of access provisions and different things that tried to address subsistence and trying to address some of the more unique Alaska characteristics of land use. And then President Carter signed the bill then in December of 1980. Stevens had voted for the Senate bill. Gravel had voted against this bill, but Stevens still maintained, and then he maintained, you know, somewhat correctly, that there were a lot of things that were tailor-made for the Alaska situation in the Senate bill that he had engineered. But when the bill came for final signing, he expressed a great wrong, but he said, "We've just begun to fight."
Right. Yeah, I think of Stevens as being against the bill, and I know that got us off subject, but it's an interesting thing about, I knew there was some conflict with Gravel and Stevens, and it must have been that filibuster that Stevens was all ready for that one to pass, and then he blamed Gravel for for it not passing, and then they didn't get as good of a deal as he wanted or something like that.
Well, that was one of many things. It goes way back.
Yeah.
They had issues going back to strategies on approving the oil pipeline.
Right. Oh, okay.
That Gravel kind of went over the top on that and won, and Stevens wanted to, you know, take a different approach on how to get approval for the oil pipeline back in 74, I think it was. There were a number of things. They just varied so much in style and strategy. And Stevens, you know, was very much a detailed kind of guy and working the trenches and, you know, looking at finer details of things. And Gravel is kind of a big picture kind of guy, and different personality.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they never did get along very well.
Which now I can circle us back to the Iditarod Trail, because Stevens was the other senator at the time when that was going through the Senate for Alaska. So did he support the Iditarod Trail and Historic Trails Act?
I'm sure he did. I don't know that. I don't recall ever having conversations with Stevens' staff specific to the Iditarod. I think it was something that Gravel had introduced originally. Stevens, I mean, you know, you don't necessarily jump in on somebody else's legislation. I think he probably got the same constituency support that Gravel did for, you know, wanting a designation. I assume he supported it. He never raised any concerns. The bill, remember, was voted on as a bigger national historic. I'm sorry, not even historic trail. It was a National Trails Act amendment in 78.
Right.
And I'm sure.
And he supported that.
I'm sure he did. Yeah.
Yeah.
He would have been on the Senate Natural Resources Committee at the time, and that would have been the first committee of
right.
jurisdiction. His votes are a matter of public record
right.
there. I just don't remember
you
what
don't
they
have
were.
Anything. Yeah, and the fact you said he didn't co-sponsor the standalone bill.
Right.
Initially.
And that wouldn't be that would not be unusual.
Okay.
You know, that would be unusual.
Okay. Well, then you also mentioned working with Senator Church's staff and getting the Iditarod Trail rolled into their bill. Knowing how the legislative process works, I wonder, what did Gravel have to give in return for that favor?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. It was not lost on his staff. I don't know about Senator Church, but his staff, you know, that was my initial meeting with them, was all about what have you done for us lately, which was not much.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. They may have just been playing a card there.
But there was nothing you and the staff negotiated
no.
back and forth on?
No. It was more an act of charity and a recognition that it was nothing off them to
right.
do it. You know, that, and it made sense. It,
right.
Substantively, it was perfectly reasonable.
Right.
And, you know, everything flowed from all the provisions of the original act. And so, that concept was not lost on my initial contact with the
right.
staff.
Well, and as you say, you know, we also wonder, well, after the fact, did Church go back to Gravel and say, okay, I did this for you now?
I don't know
yeah.
that. I kind of doubt it, because it was a pretty small thing. It,
right.
The whole thing was very, including Church's trails, were very non-controversial.
Yeah.
It had a lot of public support, not in Alaska, but I mean, for
those other
Oregon
ones,
Trail
right.
and, you know, Lewis and Clark Trail, that was a, you know, those were name brand
right.
routes in, you know, states had a way of capitalizing, you know, you put up signs and you get people to drive the route and,
right.
you know, stop at Lewis and Clark restaurants and, you know.
Well, and I think in Alaska, the fact that the Iditarod Trail sled dog race had started up,
yeah.
brought statewide recognition of something called the Iditarod Trail, which
right.
people might not have heard of before.
Right, and that, of course, Joe Reddington and others readily knew that, and that's what they were hoping for, was national recognition of the race
right.
and the route and the history of it, you know, as we know from years of following the Iditarod, the Sirum Run,
right.
you know, kind of gets blended into the Iditarod. Of course, the Sirum Run was more from Fairbanks along the Yukon River, which does utilize the Iditarod race route. It was really distinct from the original historic trail from Seward to the town of Iditarod, the old mining town,
right.
You know, different era, but you know, it all kind of, you know, blends nicely together. And in terms of the race, you know, the Sirum Run, Balto, and all of these
right.
other, the new word be memes of surrounding the, you know, the Iditarod, you know, it all was good. And oh, the race still gets national publicity,
right.
and you know, in terms of, that's what you kind of hope for on, you know, resource conservation issues, is some, you know, national moxie to it, some national recognition, and because it bestows it on the historic route and the historic resources. So, you know, we're still utilizing that connection on some of the upgrades of things down the Turnagain Arm,
mm-hmm.
Seward Highway. We have this National Scenic Byway, and parts of it are along the historic Iditarod Trail route. Forest Service and others are trying to upgrade routes, and I've been involved in a project called the Alaska Long Trail.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
And we're trying to piece together some of these segments on different people's ownership, and parts of it are the Iditarod Trail, and you know, upgrading that to, you know, different kinds of recreation, winter trail use, but summer hiking, biking, and you know, the ultimate goal is to try to get a, you know, a real usable recreation trail from Seward to, you know, on up to Fairbanks, and the first part of it all the way to, you know, Eagle River would utilize portions of the historic Iditarod Trail, same general route.
Right. So the Serum Run connection, it didn't use any of what is now the historic trail?
It did. You know, one of the race routes now goes up to Ruby.
Mm-hmm.
So the Serum Run came out of either Nenana or Fairbanks.
Nenana.
It went, you know, the Tanana to the Yukon,
right.
And then from Ruby, it would have followed the Iditarod race route over to Unalakleet and around the coast to Nome.
Okay, so they wouldn't have followed the Yukon all the way up around Galena, and they would have cut across from Ruby.
No, no. It would have been along the Yukon River,
okay.
Ruby, Galena, all the way to
Caltag,
and then over to Unalakleet, and
right.
then around.
Okay, so that part, Ruby to Unalakleet, Nome, that's the historic trail route.
Well, yeah, historic trail / Iditarod race route.
Okay.
And the race route changes, you know, year
right.
to year, and they run it all, you know,
north
a little more
south.
Along
mm-hmm.
the historic route to Iditarod and Ophir and Flat,
right.
which is now gone, but and then over to the lower part of the Yukon
right.
at Shagalock, and then up to Caltag, and then
okay.
over to Unalakleet. So, you know, and when we were doing the study, because the race was going on, and during that, it already had been an annual event, it early on we recognized that, you know, we're going to deal with branches of the route, and they all have significance. And of course, some of those portions, like Caltag to Unalakleet, shoot, that's been going on for millennium, probably.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, some of them were very well-used routes.
That was an important portage from the interior to the coast,
mm-hmm.
traditionally, for sure.
Yep. And then, you know, around the Bering Sea coast on the ice, I mean, people were doing that for a long time. There's a mm-hmm. number of villages, as you know, all the way, you know, around to Nome. Actually, some of the villages were there before Nome was there.
Yes. But so this idea that there were all these little feeder trails and
mm-hmm.
things, how did you then decide what was the main corridor to get designated?
So there's a map reference. And without looking at the report, we did try to map some of these. And
mm-hmm.
so it was more designated than just Seward to Iditarod. There were, you know, it was more branches than that. And I'm assuming, as I recall, it was a lot of the main race routes. But you'd have to look at the map. The,
right.
By the way, the other trails that were designated are kind of like that, too. Mormon Trail, Lewis and Clark, they've got alternate routes and branches, and they're referenced on the maps.
But so those alternate routes and branches are considered part of the National
yes.
Trail designation?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I thought maybe you had left those out and decided there was one main.
No.
Okay.
No. No. Yeah. And then the management plan, I think, followed up on that. And some of the right-of-way protections were extended, obviously, to
mm-hmm.
other branches and routes.
Now, after you did the study and you worked for Gravel and the trail designation passed, did you have further involvement with it?
I was trying to think. I recall testifying before the local advisory council mm-hmm. at some point, and I just don't know when that was or what they were. I think it may have been on the management plan or the beginning of the management plan, and I went down because I was still interested in, you know, follow through on the legislation. Mm-hmm. So I was somewhat involved, but I didn't follow it extremely very closely after that. Mm-hmm. It was pretty much in BLM's hands yeah. then.
And would you have testified as a Gravel staff person?
No.
Or was it personal?
It was personal.
Okay. Well, and there at one point, and Judy was talking about the issue of the Iron Dog snow machine race starting to use the trail, and that they did have some public hearings in front of the council on that. So I wonder if it was that.
I don't think so.
Okay.
No. Yeah, because I...
You think it was on the management plan?
Yeah, I think so.
And you didn't... Did you have anything to do with the management plan? And
no.
No, that was after your...
Right. I was trying to think. When I left Gravel's office in 80, I went back to school and got a master's degree. But then when I came back to Alaska, I worked then for the Alaska Federation of Natives. And I don't think there was any direct relationship there with the Iditarod.
So you have any thoughts about how it's been implemented, the management of it and that?
Yeah, I think it's been good. When I was with DNR, I did check back into what the state was doing. And they had a process, and they had one or two people or one and a half people that were going through the maps and putting, you know, on the state plats, they were trying to put real live right-of-ways because they had homesteads that they were patenting, they had these open-to-entry sites, they were inheriting land, they were transferring land to the, like, Matsu Borough, and I think in that process, they really wanted, before you hand over, you know, title to somebody else, you want to make sure the state's interests are protected through rights of way, you know, or easements or, mm-hmm. you know, other things. And so that process, I thought, had been going on. It was really slow. It was a slow, slow process. And I don't know the mechanics of that, but I think it was frustrating a little bit that we, the state, had taken so long trying to identify, because the land was being processed all the time. We were getting land, we were entitled land, the municipalities had a percentage of state lands that they were able to select, so, you know, we had these open entry sites, there was land coming and going,
right.
And, you know, the worry is that, you know, you're not going to protect certain outstanding public values in the process, whether it's historic or public or recreation, or, you know, because we had, you know, rivers that we were trying to have setbacks on that were part of the state scenic river system. Mm-hmm. You know, there were, you know, there's lots of public values, access to fishing lakes mm-hmm. and streams. So, I think that's been it's still ongoing.
Right.
For Iditarod, but for some, you know, other things too. So that's kind of a slow process. On the federal side, I have lost track. I don't know when BLM was conveying land to the state. I don't know whether they conveyed subject to certain, you know, rights and easements. I think it's the same issue, the same problem, that such an immense issue, you know, whether you, I know they, you know, there was, on the whole conveyance process, they put lines on a map and they put notice, public notice, and some things get, commented right. on, some things don't, some of these places are so far out nobody cares about, you know, and of course they were conveyed to native corporations too, so it was the same concern, and when it came to access, I mean, that there was a part of ANCSA that really called for provision of recreational access and stream bank, you know, ability for people to walk along, quote, navigable waters. And so the state's been involved in a lot of navigability identification and the issues, and that's a whole other topic. But, you know, so I guess that'd be a question for BLM, is how comfortable are they that they have identified and protected on a plat the historic route of the Iditarod Trail?
Well, it's interesting to hear you say that you feel like the state has done that. You know, I'm sort of surprised that they find some trail designation worth putting on all those land conveyances.
You're surprised that they did not?
That they did.
They did, yeah. And when I was with DNR, that process had been started. It was ongoing.
I'm surprised that they bothered to put in the trail, yeah. I guess.
Well, I was pleased, but it was short-staffed, like so many things. Right. That was not unique, but, you know, it was just a big effort for one and a half staff right. people to keep track of all of this.
And that's why I say I'm surprised they included yeah. the trail. They had much bigger things to be yeah. worrying about.
But they did, and because there was local, you know, some of these things are interesting because it's not a single person or a single interest. Sometimes it can be a coalescing of different interests. And remember, in the Mat Valley, you had people who were taking their snow machines out along these trails and in the wintertime, and they were still dog mushers, and they did not want to be cut off along these historic routes and trails by landowners. And that became an issue. And it, you know, that kind of transcends historic values, or mm-hmm. that was day-to-day values, and so there was other, and then fishermen didn't want to be cut off from walking to a stream bank of a river for fishing or a lake, and so there were people that, you know, were concerned about access, public access being cut off for a variety of uses mm-hmm. by private landowners who got conveyance, typically in the Mat Valley, from the state.
Right.
And the state realized if the Mat-Su Borough was going to take 10% of the state land as part of their municipal entitlement, that they couldn't rely on the municipality, no offense to them, but they wanted to retain some of this before or in the process of reconveying right. to the Mat-Su Borough.
Well, and you're right that for many Alaskans, all those local trails that we use, you know, and in the 70s, those guys would have been using them for a long time. They still wanted to have that access. You don't want your trail taken away.
Right.
No matter how you're using it.
Right.
And also I'm thinking the fact that the Iditarod had federal recognition and was in a congressional act, that it was federally recognized.
Right.
The state sort of had a requirement to include it.
It would have been
harder to ignore.
Right, it was flagged. It would have risen to one of the things that they would have first looked at if they were conveying to the Mat-Su over in the Kinnick area. Where do the Iditarod go? Where's the Iditarod through here? Let's make sure that we put a line on the plat that, you know, before right. we turn the title over to the Mat-Su Borough. Mat-Su Borough, by the way, I think they're now doing the same thing. I mean, they're looking at protecting their public access, you know, to streams and trails. And I mean, but whether or not they were equipped for that 20 or 30 years ago was another question.
Right.
It takes people power to do
right.
that.
Well, and as you say, the coalescing of interests, you mentioned the Reddingtons were clearly influential. Were there other constituents and people that you worked with? Well, I guess you did the study first and then in the Gravel's office.
Well, yeah, and I was trying to think about that. I think I, at one point, talked to Dorothy Page over in Connecticut. Of course, she was a big race promoter and a keeper of kind of Iditarod memorabilia and did all kinds of work with the race. I don't recall when and what the conversation consisted of. I may have just talked to her once or twice. And she was a big race route supporter. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how much of the actual trail history that she conveyed, but she was certainly a booster of the race. And I don't, you know, there was agency people that I, you know, worked with, particularly BLM. And then maybe, you know, the Seward section, a lot of that was through Tugetch National Forest, and I know we touched base and talked with the Forest Service, and ever since, I mean, they've been very cooperative and active in protecting and constructing, you know, real trail along some of the route, and they continue to be involved in that.
Now, when you worked on the original study, that Gold Rush Trails study,
yeah,
did you go out to the communities along the trail and talk to people to find out histories of those sections, or?
I can't read, not much, because the, you know, a lot of the real history would be in Iditarod and Flat, and both those places were long abandoned.
Right.
Not much left, and of course we looked at things like roadhouses and some of the structures at Iditarod and Flat, and whether or not, you know, they merited reconstruction, or whether that should be, you know, buildings should be part of the Iditarod. And by then, a lot of it was gone, and or sunk.
Right.
You know, these log cabins, they just sink into the surrounding land. I do think, though, that we did talk about and think about, if you had ever a winter route that people were interested in recreating on, that reconstruction or use of public use cabins along the route would enhance the route and be very compatible with the historic trail designation. So that was a, you know, a concept. You know, others have tried for a long time to try to institute a hut-to-hut system in Alaska,
right,
that was similar to what was there over 100 years
right
ago. And, oh my gosh, you know, like there's a group been trying to do this down in the Kenai Peninsula area for a long time, and just one hurdle after another. That's a whole other story, but... And my work on the Alaska Long Trail and others through Alaska Trails,
right,
we've talked a lot about hut-to-hut, and both from a recreational standpoint, but also an economic standpoint, getting people, you know, there are lots of examples around the world, fewer in the United States,
right,
of, you know, where, you know, like I've done hikes in the Dolomites in northern Italy where you know, you don't take a tent, you don't,
right,
you know, you go to very nice huts and sleep and get stuff to eat, and it's a huge draw, and you know, people pay, you know, 50-70 bucks a night for the privilege of staying in a hut.
Well, and as you said, you know, historically on the Iditarod Trail there were roadhouses a day apart and a place to put up your dogs and all those kinds of things that much more quote-unquote civilized or advanced than what's out there now.
Yeah.
It was a very populated area for a while.
Yeah. Yeah, we have a different kind of culture, both in Alaska, particularly in Alaska, for, you know, our public use cabins. People want to have them for themselves or their family.
Right.
They rent a $50 or a $75 a night cabin, and they don't want to share it. But that's not true in so many other places of the world. And you can really up the game considerably with, you know, larger facilities, but public facilities that are available and to people that, you know, where you don't have to take a tent, and you don't have to cook your meals and pack all that. And, on scenic routes, I mean, Alaska has huge potential for attracting international tourism and visitors if we had, you know, a system. And you don't have to look very far. I mean, there are, you know, New Zealand and, and Switzerland and
it's all over.
And lots of people, and it can be managed. And they're still walking on, you know, little trails. And, so I think there are people now in Alaska kind of who are in recreation industry or recreational businesses that are seeing this possibility. And local chambers of commerce are like Matsu and Talkeetna and Healy. I mean, they're kind of seeing how this could be something significant.
Well, as you say, I'm part of the historic Iditarod Trail. It could be hiking in the summertime, but other parts it would have to be a winter, either ski, snow machine access, dog mushing access.
Yeah.
So when you were doing the research, you said, you researched the records and the old roadhouses and things. But as we mentioned, that Kaltag to Unalakleet has a very long native tradition of use. Did you look into any of those historic uses?
A little bit. It usually came through the old government reports where, say, in the early 1900s, you get a early USG, what was then or now USGS type exploration report, and they would be retracing in places or a lot even historic native routes, and they would reference that. They would say we met people from Kaltag going across the Unalakleet. It seems to be this is a very old historic route that's been utilized between the coast and interior Athabascan people for, forever. So there were, we saw references like that that were in the early literature. And, we should be thankful for some of these old government folks that it wasn't easy work, and they trooped all over, and they, of course, and there were people, government people and enforce the law type people who were following Gold Rush people because there were problems. You had to have law and order with any of the gold camps and gold routes and so there were lots of people who were making reports and taking notes, and some were better than others, obviously. That's always the problem with recorded history, but we have quite a bit of literature. And then the Klondike had quite a bit of good history. I've tried to think of the author who wrote kind of the classic.
Pierre Breton.
Yes, and his book is just a treasure house of history of not just the Klondike, but reaching the Klondike and all the routes that people went to get to the Klondike. And there was stuff associated with Nome that way. Although Nome was a lot easier to get to. You could take a ship all the way to Nome, or there were people who actually went down the Yukon River from the Klondike.
Right.
And you could go all the way. And for travel, the Yukon River spreads out in this giant delta, and the same steam wheelers that plied up and down the Yukon, they would get stuck at the mouth.
Right.
So you had to park the steamship, the boats, paddle wheelers, and there used to be still a few parked over there, and then you had to either go overland or go to the ocean and then catch a boat to go to Nome. you couldn't make it the whole way.
See, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and I was wondering, you know, that whether for that study you traveled to the villages and talked to people about the trail in their area and if how they used it and was it important to them, but it sounds like you didn't.
Some. I was trying to think.
And I wondered why you might not have gone.
Yeah, I don't recall getting primary type information from villages beyond what everybody knew, like the Unalakleet Pass.
Right.
And their experience would be modern use of historic routes.
Right.
And they certainly knew the race routes. And you know, there was nobody left around in flat and they did it right.
No, I was just thinking that the native, you know,
yeah.
In 1977, 76, you know, an elder would have maybe known what happened in the 1920s, you know.
Yeah,
maybe.
I did talk to, when I was looking at the Wiseman routes, I went to Fairbanks, I talked to an old guy, Estes, his name was Estes, E-S-T-E-S. He was in his late 80s or 90s, and he actually was around and utilized some of the routes out of Fairbanks to reach the central Yukon, central Brooks Range area. And unfortunately, this is another good example of be nice, you know, of oral history and trying to get it. He was somewhat forgetful of things. I remember being a little bit frustrated. I didn't get quite all the information I was hoping for. And then, you know, he died somewhat, you know, a year or so after that. But he had traveled some of these routes, and he knew in a broad way where he had traveled. But even that, you know, would have been 50 years
right.
prior to that, which would have been in the 20s,
right.
as opposed to the early 1900s.
Right, but yeah, as you say, you can't get all the way back, but
right.
you could get some of that history.
Right, and then I think I have talked to folks in the Wiseman Nolan. Nolan
mm-hmm.
is a
yeah.
related to town, and I did look into that a little bit about, and then, you know, it's interesting. Some of these benefited from authors.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Marshall
right.
traveled in the Central Brooks Range early on in the 20s, and he wrote some books about not just climbing, but he wrote a book about Wiseman and Nolan.
Right.
And it was a social, kind of more a social history, but it commented on things. And so, you know, obviously those are the gems that, you know, you try to pick up. And there were a few written about different things. Don't recall anything specific to the Iditarod. That was, you know, one of those collection of
right.
early on adventures and experiences.
Well, and it, you know, you're correct in reminding me that study was not just of the Iditarod. You had all these other trails.
Yeah.
And I assume you had a time frame and a budget to work within?
Yeah. And I think we were trying to get them all done in a couple of years. It would have been 74 to 76. And we, you know, the first task was zeroing in on what are the highest potential trails here? And that's, I think I said
mm-hmm.
earlier, how we narrowed down to primarily the Iditarod.
Right.
That seemed to have the highest potential.
And then how was that work all funded? What kind of funding did you have?
We were utilizing the just existing manpower, the allocation for the Alaska BOR, Bureau of Outdoor Recreation Office. And, you know, there were, when we started the historic trails, there was two or three, we had some people leave, the original five of us, we had two or three of us
that were in the office, and it was funded, the personnel was funded in travel right from, you know, the regular Bureau of Outdoor Recreation budget through the Department of Interior.
Okay, that was my question.
Yeah, and we didn't have any extra, there was no specific money for that. I'm trying to think how to phrase it. We had time available to do things once the original studies were done on our Wild and Scenic Rivers project. There was still ongoing work, and we were still, in the summertime, we were still taking river inspections and finishing up EISs for the proposals, but the proposals for the rivers and the Alaska Lands work had largely been transmitted to the Congress through the Department of Interior. Secretary C.B. Morton introduced the kind of the first administration bill under the Reagan administration fairly early on, must have been 74. And then there were a lot of modifications subsequently.
So who was the director of the
I don't mean, pardon me.
You said Reagan administration.
I meant
I know
Nixon.
I wasn't going to correct you. I don't think that was the Reagan administration.
Nixon.
So for the Bureau of Recreation office here in Alaska that you were working for, who was the head of that that would have made your sort of work assignment decisions?
The original guy was Jules Tileston, who's still here. He and I were the lone survivors and still alive and still in Alaska. And he took us all through the Wild and Scenic Rivers studies. And I can't remember, I think we started the trail studies. He was still I don't know what we call it, the Alaska field director, head of the Alaska office.
And what was his first name?
Jules, J-U-L-E-S, Tileston, T-I-L-E-S-T-O-N, and he went on then to become the head of resources for the BLM state office.
Any relations into Peg Tileston?
Husband.
Okay.
Yep, she's been here and quite involved with a host of different things.
I know her name, yeah, okay.
But Jules, I just did a article for the Park Service on Wild and Scenic Rivers and some of the early work, and Jules reviewed he was one of the reviewers of the thing, and he's still involved, still active, and I assume as head of resources, and he was then probably charged in supervising the management plan for the Iditarod Trail.
Yeah, that was BLM, I think.
He
went over to BLM?
Yep, as chief of resources.
Okay.
For the state office, Alaska state office of BLM.
Okay. And then who else worked with you in...
And then after he left, which I can't quite remember, it was before the trails work was completed, was Bill Thomas.
Okay.
And at one point, just he and I were left in the office.
So you did most of that trail study then on your own?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. And after Jules left as Bureau of Recreation, who was in charge? He was in charge the whole time you were there?
No. He was there for 2 or 3 years while we were doing the Wild and Scenic River study, and then at some point he went on to BLM.
Right.
And the office head then was transferred in was Bill Thomas,
okay,
who was the Alaska head.
Okay. And you were the only staff person?
Yeah.
Wow. And then eventually the Office of Recreation, the Bureau of Recreation went away.
Shortly after I left, then in early 77, or in the spring of 77, sometime in 77, it changed its name to become what was colloquially called Hookers, Heritage Conservation and Recreation Service.
Oh, that's right.
It was a you know, in keeping with, you know, Fish and Wildlife Service, National Park Service. And I don't know whether that was an administrative change, but then, not too long after that, the whole organization merged back into the National Park Service,
okay,
where they had originally come from, back in the 60s, when the Land and Water Conservation Fund was established in the 60s, BOR, Bureau of Outdoor Recreation, was established to administer the fund and to do some of these other, they were charged with wild scenic rivers, national trail studies. They had a state, there was a state planning function. You needed a SCORP, or a state comprehensive outdoor recreation plan, to qualify for the Land and Water Conservation Funds. So that was their bread and butter. And they peeled people out of the Park Service originally to form the Bureau of Outdoor Recreation. In the end, they folded back in.
Okay. Well, that's why, yeah, Bob Spoody was involved, I think, when it was the Heritage Conservation and Recreation Service as a historian. So I've heard that word before. Well, this has been very informative. You have all these wonderful notes in front of you to refresh your memory. Have we covered all of that?
Yes, we have. Done.
Okay, good. I want to make sure we get all your memories and experiences. And
yeah.
I was going to say, I think it was helpful that as a researcher, you liked to do outdoor recreation and could go scout parts of the trail, you personally.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the benefits of the entire job. I help do an Anoka training class every year, a couple times a year, and my part has one conclusion, that work in the Wild Scenic Rivers program was the best job I ever had, where the government paid me to go float rivers all over the state.
Yeah.
It was fabulous. And trails, I tried to take that same model and go out and go look at some of these trails, and in this case, in the wintertime.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, do you think that experience of doing the studies and going out on the Iditarod Trail influenced what you did in Gravel's office and pushing for it to get included?
Yeah, I was very much a convert and an advocate for trail, Iditarod Trail designation as a historic trail. I thought that made a lot of sense, and I had, of course, a lot invested by then by putting a couple of years' effort into the Gold Rush Trail study or report that we did and submitted to Congress. Yeah.
So any other thoughts on the challenges or the obstacles you faced through this process? I mean,
no.
Other than the 32 below.
No, I will say,
you make it sound like it all just went so smoothly and was perfect.
Yeah. Well, it largely did. I think that, all this kind of project, getting oral history, is great. And as you so well know, it's still limited, and limited by old people's memory like me. And, you know, different versions of the same thing. There was a great article in this morning's paper, or yesterday's paper, about by Ray Ohm, the historian, about a little scuffle between Senator Greening and Senator Bartlett, early senators from Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And the conclusion was interesting, that Greening wrote a book, which I have on my bookshelf, signed by him, that Bartlett very much disagreed with a lot of Greening's narrative of historical events, saying that it was overblown or mm-hmm. not accurate. And, you know, history is full of that.
Right.
But the guy that writes the book, and, you know, Audie Murphy, won all kinds of awards for valor in World War II. And my dad, who was in World War II, always said, yeah, and he always had a reporter next to him reporting on his good deeds and valor. So, you know, it's obviously gets slanted, but I think when you do a wide variety of people from a wide variety of standpoints, you know, you get some things that kind of coalesce.
Right, and you know, we have these written documents.
Yeah.
We have the Gold Rush studies you did. We have these comprehensive plans. So it's nice to hear the experiences of the people behind those and say, you know, it all builds on it.
Yeah.
And helps tell the story.
Yeah.
So appreciate your time today. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. It's always fun to go back and relive and remember some of these things.
All right. Thanks.